Evening, everyone. Broadcasting live. Don't know, something's very wrong with my computer now. Firefox, anyway. Firefox is really causing problems. Anyway, tonight's quote is from the Madhyama Nikaya. Vatta Sutta, Madhyama Nikaya number 7. Sayatapi bhikkhave vattang sankirittang malangahittang. Just as bhikkhus, a cloth, sankirittang is defiled, malangahittang, stained. Tamenang rajako yasming ranga jate. Upasangharaya. And then a person who dyes cloth would like to dip it in yasming rangajate, in various kinds of dyes, whether it be nila. Nilaka is color is nilaka, blue, yellow or red, pitaka or lohitaka. Or white, no, what's the other one? A red or crimson, don't know what crimson is. Some crimson red. Durata vannam mevasa, aparisuddha vannam mevasa. Not be properly dyed. That's not quite the translation. Durata varnam. It will be hard to dye it, and it will have a durata, poorly dyed color. Aparisuddha varnam evasa, of an impure color. So if your cloth is impure, doesn't matter what color dye you put it in, it's not going to come out clean. So apropos of today, don't know if Tina's watching, but just received an outer robe. So Tina sent that from, we sent it from here to Washington State, and Tina sent it, sewed it all up, put a wool liner on it, and then sent it back. I tried dyeing the other cloth, but my dyeing skills aren't up to snuff. You need really good dye, and you need the equipment. You really need a pot and a fire, and so on. In Sri Lanka, we used to dye our clothes, or we once dyed. I dyed cloth in Sri Lanka. I dyed cloth in Thailand once, in Sri Lanka once. In Sri Lanka, I ordained my first novice, and they gave him these bright, bright orange robes. And so we thought, that's okay, we'll just dye them. And so we got this pot, not a big enough pot, but we put it over a fire outside and started heating it up, and then we put the robe on a stick and slowly lowered it in and lifted it up. And then he went and washed that, and we tried it for the second one and we put it in. Oh, and it came out bright orange. And we realized the second one wasn't cotton, it was polyester. So it wouldn't take the dye at all. So we could also adapt this and say polyester cloth. If your mind is like polyester cloth, if your mind is fake, doesn't matter what you do. If your heart isn't in the right place, if you're not sincere in mind, if you're not pure of heart, nothing you do will turn out well. Whether you live in the world, whether you live as a Buddhist monk, or whether you become rich or poor or stay poor, whether you have ambitions to become a doctor or a lawyer, business person, or even the president of the United States of America, nothing you do will turn out right. It'll just be full of stress and suffering, mottled like a cloth that is already stained and dirty. If a cloth is stained and dirty, the dye won't take, and when you wash it, the dye will be blotched and uneven. And then he says something that my teacher often would repeat. Chitte sankinite dugate patikanka. Chitte asankinite sugate patikanka. For a mind, or when the mind is defiled, chitte. When the mind, sankhilite, is defiled. Dugati, a bad destination. Patikanka means without doubt. There is a bad destination. It means hell is the or a bad destination. One of the lower realms of existence is the result. Or in general, just a bad future is certain. Chitte asankirite sugati patikanka. When the mind is undefiled, sugati, su is good, a good destination, patikanka is without a doubt. In Buddhism, it's all about the mind. When your mind is defiled, you mess up everything. You're stressed, you suffer. You can have all the riches in the world, but you're constantly worried or stressed or covetous, angry, frustrated, fighting. So much suffering. All these, actually, suffering that we kind of take for granted is maybe not the word, we become complacent about. We don't realize that there's any way to be free. We think of happiness as a way of, as that, whatever way we can find to find respite from these inevitable feelings that we have. the inevitable impurities that we have. And so we're always trying to find a way to block them out. And so we don't realize how much more happy we can be than really the happiest non-meditator on earth, whether they be rich or powerful, whatever happiness or pleasure they might have. It can never be as much as a person who is free from the desires and so on. Because it's always going to be a flame, there's always going to be obsession and concern and worry and boredom and reaction and the constant struggle to find, no matter how powerful or rich or well off you are. Even up in heaven, even the angels have worries and cares and can get angry, upset. Not often, but it does happen. When an angel gets angry, apparently it's a cause for them to fall from heaven. They die from heaven if they get really angry. Apparently the commentary says something like that. It's because heaven is caused by pure mind states. One is born in heaven because of purity of mind. Mundane purity or super mundane as well. So for that very good reason, we should take care of our minds and try and be as mindful as we can of our defilements, study them, learn about them, free ourselves from them. Anyway, so that's our Dhamma quote for tonight. I'm going to post the hangout, but again, mostly for people asking questions. If you do have questions, join the hangout. I've pasted it at meditation.sirimangalo.org. And click on the link. Otherwise, we'll just call it a night. Hello, Ben. Do you have a question?
Hello.
Do you have a question for me?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
My question was. Sorry, I wrote it down before. I'm trying to do the five precepts, but I struggle with the not eating meat side of things. And I recently found out that the Dalai Lama isn't necessarily a vegetarian.
I don't even know if he keeps the five precepts, because I heard someone tell me that someone asked him, what do you do if a mosquito lands on your arm? And he said, well, you go like this, you brush it off.
Yeah.
And they said, well, what if it lands on your arm again? And he said, well, you brush it off again. And they said, well, what if it lands on your arm again? And he says, well, apparently he did that.
Yeah.
This is what I heard. I didn't see the interview, but apparently that was an interview. So I don't even know if he keeps the five precepts. I know in Tibetan Buddhism sometimes there is some talk about drinking alcohol in certain instances. So
it's a Theravada thing or a Vipassana thing, or
Theravada,
not necessarily.
In Theravada we keep... You have to understand the Mahayana. They came up with this idea of expedient means, whereby you can break precepts if it helps, if it supposedly helps you spread the Dharma, teach whatever, teach your teachings, bring people to closer to enlightenment. Our argument is that it could never do that. Breaking the precepts, inherently not good.
No.
So. But that being said, eating meat is not killing.
No. And that was the, that was kind of the, that was kind of the explanation for it. It's like the meat, he didn't kill the animal.
No, it's not, the act of eating is not killing.
Yeah.
So the act of eating is not breaking one of the five precepts.
All right.
If you want to argue that there's connections, that's not what the precepts are about. The precepts are refraining from those actions that are, well, not only unwholesome, but are extremely unwholesome, that are dangerously unwholesome. So there's a lot of things that aren't in the five precepts. Gambling isn't in the five precepts. Torture isn't in the five precepts.
Yeah.
So it's just these are recognized, and they're simple as well, so they're easy for people to understand. Okay, don't kill. I mean, it's really a no-brainer. So they're a good basic set of rules for people to keep. That's all the five precepts are. You shouldn't take them as the entirety of morality. Morality is about your state of mind. If your mind is, as I just went through, if your mind is pure, you go to heaven and get closer to freedom as well. If your mind is impure, you get more entangled.
Right.
So a person can eat meat with a pure mind. And that's why, according to our school of Buddhism, it's not really an issue.
Right.
We're not really into social justice or that kind of thing. We're into mental peace of mind, mental health. And the rest we figure comes, like if you stop killing, and if you, more importantly, if you stop mind states that are cruel, you know, people will stop killing animals for meat in the first place.
Yeah. So you can still be a good Buddhist and eat meat as long as you're not killing.
Yeah, I mean, if you're living in the world, you should be careful and you should be aware. It's one of those things that has issues surrounding it. I mean, it's very close to killing. So if you're buying meat, well, you know, not really a good thing, you know. I wouldn't feel guilty about it necessarily, but something you should be conscious of. If I'm buying meat, well, I'm kind of, you know, it's not really perfect. So moving towards vegetarianism, I think, is a great thing. I don't see that. There's no point in eating meat. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for your health. The only thing good about it is people are addicted to the taste, and that's not Buddhist, so... Absolutely, I think vegetarianism is great, but I say that, and at the same time wanting to be clear that it's not the eating the meat that's a problem, it's the, you know, well, it's killing that is a problem. So if you do eat meat, you shouldn't feel guilty about it, but it's, as a socially aware sort of thing to do, moving towards vegetarianism I think is useful, important, good. There's lots of reasons for it. One of them, my teacher, someone came to my teacher and said he was eating vegetarian and said, oh good, you won't get bird flu. Because there was the big bird flu scare. Well, not scare, it was a horrible bird flu situation in Thailand and Asia.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for him to say that because the Buddha said something similar. He said, we have it recorded in the Tipitaka, you know, whether it's real or not, but this is what the Buddha supposedly said. Before the killing of animals for food, before the killing of cows, I think he said specifically, there were only three diseases in the world. And after they started killing cows, 100 and some new diseases arose. So I mean, whatever that means, but the sentiment of it is really interesting that the Buddha would say something that is really, you know, something we should recognize, is that animals... Killing animals, not just the eating of them, but the process of killing and having their blood in the sewers and that kind of thing, leads to a lot more sickness.
Oh, absolutely. The things that happen when animals are killed and that, like, environmental impact and things like that. There's, you know, Cowspiracy, that documentary, I don't know, you probably, you know, just shows the impact of what meat eating does for the growing population and that. But neither here nor there, really. Yeah, if you've not seen it. But
not to mention how awful it is to this, all the killing that goes on. It's awful. There's no question. We're not ignorant to that. I'm not ignorant to that.
But so you can still take the five precepts and
don't worry about eating meat. But you know, I think a good Buddhist thing to do is to move towards vegetarianism as much as you can. But if you end up eating meat, if you're offered meat or something, or the opportunity arises to eat meat, I wouldn't think twice. I wouldn't bat an eyelash.
It doesn't exclude you from being a good Buddhist.
No, you shouldn't feel guilty about it. I mean, Buddhism isn't about feeling guilty anyway. Buddhism is about learning to be happy, finding a way to be truly happy. There's no reason to be unhappy because you're chewing on somebody's dead body. They've left it. They're gone. They've moved on.
Yeah. They're already gone. They're not feeling any pain.
They have no interest in it anymore.
And as far as like the sort of 10 precepts and that, the, you know, not beautifying yourself and things like that, and, or is that more a monastic kind of thing?
There's 8 precepts that people will take when they come here to practice, or when they go to a meditation center in this tradition to practice. And then novices will take 10, and as a Buddhist monk, I have hundreds.
Yes, that must be quite challenging. Well,
there are a lot of minor rules.
Yeah.
It's not that challenging. It can be at times.
No. As long as you got your isolation, I guess.
Yeah, we were talking about it. I shaved my head recently, and this one, I had been talking to this woman, and she said, "So can I touch you?" And I said, "Well, you know, technically, you can do whatever you want. You don't have the rules." I said, "I can't touch you, and I can't really, you know, I can't. I think I have to say something, or if I know you're going to touch me, I can't offer myself to be touched. That kind of thing, you know."
Yeah.
And so when I shaved my head, she reached over and rubbed my head, the top of my head.
You're saying a lot of this stuff is just sort of dogma, like it's part of the institution, not necessarily part of the what it's all about.
Then I talked to her about it. She said, "You know, I can do," and I said, "Well, you know, it's." She said, "There's no rules," and I said, "Well, there are rules in cultures, and they make a lot of sense. Like in Thailand, if my Thai students found out that someone had rubbed my head, a woman had rubbed my head, it's breaking so many rules. It's wrong on many, many levels." I mean, you don't ever touch anyone's head in Thailand unless they're 10, 20 years younger than you. Yeah, and let alone a person touching a monk's head and a woman touching a monk's head. But whatever, it's not her rules. And, you know, I think that's important. It's important that we make it clear that we are not trying to impose anything on you. And I think we could argue that it's a bit disrespectful to go around rubbing monks' heads. I think the idea is it's important for people to get there on their own rather than be like, "Oh, you know, that's wrong. Don't do that," kind of thing.
Yeah, it's about the art.
She didn't have any... She's just being silly. Anyway, her name is Grace Anne. There's a group of us where we're adult learners.
Yeah.
Her, and then there's another woman, Carrie. We're all in this Buddhism class together.
Yep.
And we.
But novice, fair game.
Sorry?
Novice, fair game, though.
I can't hear you.
Novice is a fair game, though. You can they're pretty much
novices, did you say?
Yeah, I went to the Wat Sawan Mok and near Chaya, near Suratani. They have like the international Dharma heritage there, and they said all the rules for the monks and everything like that. And then there was another guy who was a novice monk, and they said, yeah, those rules don't apply to him. You can pretty much.
Well, you know, novices in Thailand and monks in Thailand in general. Although Suan Mok, I think, is probably pretty good, but you know, Buddhadasa was a bit out on his own path anyway. But novices in Thailand are. I mean, I remember when I was in Thailand, and there was this. They ordain them so young, and they have no idea, and the novices are not interested in Buddhism at all, really. And so there was this novice who was just doubled over in pain because he hadn't eaten in the morning, and he was just so hungry, and so. I remember what happened. He had. Everyone was picking on him. He was a little bit weird. There was this really interesting case. He was like a feral child almost. Not feral, but he hadn't ever really been taken care of, so he could speak. But he had no manners and no sense of etiquette, and very much like a very, very animalistic in many ways. He was a hard kid, but he was a nice kid. He was just didn't really understand social mores and niceties. And so he ordained as a novice with all these other kids, and he was playing with them. And one time he was running in through a door, and I think he like grabbed grabbed something, and someone slammed the door on his baby finger and cut off a good 3/4 of an inch. Probably a whole knuckle, actually. And I think they put it back on, or I can't remember. But anyway, he was blood everywhere in terrible pain, and they didn't know what to do with him. So I said I'd take care of him, or I just took him in. You know, he was really upset, and so I just took him into my kuti, and he stayed with me for at least one night. I think he stayed with me one night, and then when they saw that we got along really well, he ended up staying with me for a few more nights, I think. But anyway, so then at night he was really, because there was many things he couldn't eat. Apparently, if you have, they were afraid of infection or something. My Thai wasn't very good at the time. This was many, many years ago. And I didn't quite understand what he was talking about. But I said, so can you have this? Can you have this? And he said, no, I can't have this. And he was really sad and crying because he couldn't eat all the foods that he wanted. I said, what about, is there anything you can eat? And he said, oh, this fish I can eat. I said, okay. I gave him 20 baht and said, go get that fish. Back then, this was early in the years, I was still using money. Most monks in Thailand use money. And so I just had him. It was evening, you know. It was middle. I said, here's the money, go get your fish. So they, I mean, they don't really, I don't know. I mean, I obviously wouldn't do that now, but there was another time where, here in Stony Creek, my first year as a monk, the same thing, you know, these kids come and, that was a really interesting summer. All these young Canadian-born kids who had way less interest in Buddhism than the Thai kids. And they came and they were bribed to become novices, like given hundreds of dollars just to stay with us for 2 weeks. And so they just lay around and play their PlayStation after they became novices. They just lay, and they were right in the room beside me, and they were cursing and swearing and talking about women in derogatory ways, and you know, just it got to the point. Because I didn't want anything to do with this. I said, this is not, you know, for me. But finally, I'd had enough, and you shouldn't be doing this in a monastery as novices. So I went and I threw the breaker on their room. And this was the middle of the summer where it was deadly hot. And so suddenly their fans didn't work, their lights didn't work, their PlayStation certainly didn't work. Anyway, there was an interesting summer, but one interesting part was there was a very, very thin, high metabolism kid who was just ready to faint because he didn't have enough food. Now, if he had been interested in meditation, he probably could have done away with it, but these were really a lost cause. None of them should have been ordained.
Yeah.
You know, it was a really interesting experience for them. I will give you that, but I don't know. There were good pros and cons for it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, and so there was him. He was like super thin, and he became friends with with another kid, one of the other young novices, who was like a bowling ball, pudgy, who was also very hungry, but he was clearly doing okay. So I went in the kitchen. This was at night. I went in the kitchen. I made a tuna sandwich because I knew they weren't allowed to eat in the evenings. I made this tuna sandwich or something, put it out on the counter, and then I walked over to their room and I said to him, I said, "Now there's a tuna sandwich in the kitchen on the counter, and if I come back and it's gone, well, you know, it's gone." And so he ran into the kitchen, and then the other kid with the bigger kid looks at me like this. Like, you don't need one.
But obviously you're familiar with Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, his writings. Do you have any sort of take on that? Because he seems very pragmatic.
There's a lot of scholars, mainstream Buddhist scholars in Thailand are critical of him. That's what I know.
All right.
So, personally, what I know is that he was eclectic and had his own sort of take on things. That's as far as I know. I don't know too much about him.
Right.
I know. Of course, he wrote the Handbook for Mankind, and he taught Anapanasati. It's just a different tradition. So it's just a different tradition from ours. So obviously, it's inferior. I just don't know how inferior. I'm just kidding.
Got to find your tribe, I guess. Find your people. And
no, I'm just kidding. I mean, obviously, I believe our tradition is best, but you know, could there be a better one? Sure. So I don't. I'm just being silly.
Yeah. But he was quite a renowned Buddhist scholar, as far as I understood.
Well, he was prolific.
They were saying like the whole, there's libraries of his translations and that in Bangkok.
Early on, when I was studying Buddhism, early on, just looking at all teachers, after I'd practiced meditation, I didn't really know what tradition we were in. I didn't know we were affiliated with Mahasi Sayadaw, so I just started reading all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And but what was interesting, I left Jom Tong, the meditation center, went to Bangkok, and I was looking for a book on Buddhism. And I went to Asia Books in Bangkok, in one of the big towers, and just went to the Buddhism section, and I looked, and there were books, you know, with flowers on them and all sorts of things. But then there was this one book, black cover, with an oval picture frame on the front, and a drawing of this monk with black rimmed glasses looking like this.
Yes. Yeah. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. Yeah.
No, not Buddhadasa. Not Buddhadasa. Mahasi Sayadaw. Anyway, point is, my first book was on Mahasi Sayadaw, but then I read all sorts of other things. And so Mahasi Sayadaw, and this was at a time I had no idea that he was at all affiliated with what we were doing. But when I read this book, it was really, it affected me deeply. It resonated with me. I read Handbook for Mankind, or part of it, most of it, and it didn't resonate with me. And this, again, was at a time where I didn't know who was who. So it was unbiased. And it was kind of boring. I found Handbook for Mankind kind of dull. On the other hand, I also found Upandita's book in this very life to be rather dull. So I don't know.
One thing I find a little bit frustrating is, there's the four tetrads, and like you got step 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then you're meant to go into the right. jhanas and all that, but mm-hmm. it doesn't happen. Like, very rare for as a layman in that, and like in amongst like the 70 or 80 other people that were there at the retreats and that, they're all going, okay, well, it's time to move on to step 5, but step 5, you know, the absorption never really happens.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I wouldn't take the book that way. I mean, he's basically telling what's going on, and the texts are all talking about this. He's just reciting what's in the text. So, right. But you really need lots of time to get there. I wouldn't put a time limit on it. You can't just say, now we're going to go to the next step. You can't choose when you go to the next step.
No, it's very seductive, though. It's a very, sounds like it'd be a very pleasant state to sort of get into. I don't know, I've never experienced this myself. And speaking to, one of the older monks there, I said, how many times have you experienced the lights of the mind, the jhanas? And he said, maybe 4 times in my whole life. So that was a bit of a letdown for me. But I don't know. Do you have any sort of feedback on that?
I didn't quite catch what you were saying.
The absorb, like when you're getting to the state where you're sort of seeing the lights in the mind, with like
tradition is very different from ours. I don't follow Buddha Dasa, it's a different tradition.
Yeah.
So
Cha sort of was along the same.
If you see lights in our tradition, you would say to yourself, seeing.
Yeah.
Until it goes away.
Yeah. Totally different style, I guess.
Alexander, do you have a question?
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to ask. I'm sorry that my camera isn't working. There's a certain problem with it. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I wanted to ask you that how did you take all the Buddhist view with you being sort of a Westerner?
I don't understand. You mean the Thai view, I think. No?
Okay, the Thai view. Okay.
How did I handle it?
How did you take it? I'm sorry if my English is not good.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
How did you sort of encompass it within you? How did you create it, your own view? How did you fell into it? How did it start to resonate with you?
Did I appreciate it, or was it hard for me to be in Thailand, for example? Is that what you're trying to ask? Or what? Or as a person who has no background in Buddhism, how was I able to appreciate Buddhism?
So I watched your video about how you became a Buddhist monk. So I was interested in how did you... because you had all the Western views. I presume.
Well, I was a Taoist at the time. I was really into Taoism, or the Tao Te Ching anyway. That was my religion at the time.
Uh-huh.
So not really. I didn't have a lot of Western views. I'm kind of a weird sort of person. I grew up in the forest. I was homeschooled. I was very anti-Christian. I think it still shows. But kind of really... I think there were two types of people that I really didn't like, Americans and Christians. Like that was sort of my belief at the time.
I've got to log out now.
Okay.
But thanks so much for your time.
Nice to see you.
You too. Thanks very much.
Have a good night. Good morning.
Whatever. You too.
Right, so yeah, just that, and I was brought up Jewish, but didn't subscribe to any views. If the only view I might have had is a view of God, but I'd kind of grown out of that as well. I don't remember, but I was very much, I don't know. I mean, I've seen people who come to Thailand, lots of them, and are very, very critical. I think, I don't know. I remember, I vaguely remember something, some sort of experience that, or some sort of philosophy that I had come across was like not to be that way. I didn't want to be that person. Maybe it was more of a like, not be a tourist, you know? If you go to a place, and I think that that's another category of person, the people who go to, say, Thailand and are very keen to follow the Thai ways. There's two types of people. I suppose I would fall more in the type of person who was keen to fit in. I was very keen to fit in. Eventually, I grew out of that, but I think that's how it was easy is I was keen to fit in. So I was very impressionable and purposefully, I guess. I was really letting myself get caught up in the ways of the country to some extent. I mean, obviously not. But I think the real people who have a real problem are those people who are, I guess you could say, ditticharita, who are uncompromising in their views and believe they shouldn't have to bend, or they're not interested in it. Maybe they don't, they should, they don't have to, but they're of the belief that they're of the bent not to change their views. So just because everyone else does it this way, you know, when in Rome, screw the Romans, kind of thing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much about answering this question. So another question that I had is sort of like, of course, you talk a lot about suffering and like, for example, you find yourself into a situation which you know that causes you problems, that someone had made you angry, or you recognize the problem, but you still cannot detach yourself from it. You cannot relieve the pain. So what do you do in those moments?
Well, you failed.
You,
That's a
as in, what does one do?
failure. You weren't capable enough, mindful enough, pure enough to deal with it. So there's nothing you can do. You failed. The idea is to train ourselves so that doesn't happen. You know, when you're upset, well, it's already too late. You've already gotten upset. I mean, that's sort of that's a more cutting answer, but a more generic answer is you would just, you know, pick up the pieces and try again. You would, in other words, you'd be mindful when you're angry, when you're upset. You know? Be mindful of your upset. You'd say to yourself, upset, upset. I mean, that's really the beauty of the practice, is you can never be in a situation where you can't start meditating, where it's too late, where you're incapable of it. Now, no matter what the situation is, once you realize, once you have the awareness, you say, oh, I'm really angry, then absolutely you can start meditating right then. But it's really about building up the habit of it so that it becomes habitual, so that when someone yells at you right away, you say hearing, hearing, or if you get upset, you say upset, and you're quick to cut it off. That's why we meditate. You know, when you meditate, it provides you with this. We have to
Thank
train.
you. Thank you. I guess I'm not like you. I'm not like most of your followers or serious people who watch this. I don't meditate regularly.
Well, there's your
So,
problem. Have you read my booklet?
No, actually, I was sort of yesterday. I was in my country. It's like 4 a.m. So I was hanging on the internet, and I saw that you're going live, and I listened to you.
Okay.
I got all agitated, like, how can I join? How can I ask?
Well, if you're interested, you're welcome to I'd recommend you read my booklet on how to meditate.
Yes, I downloaded it. I'm going to read it.
What's your native language?
Macedonian.
Whoa.
It's a Slavic language.
Don't think we have a Macedonian translation.
No, you do not need it. I understand English perfectly well.
Yeah, you have. Yeah.
Okay, so if you do not mind, I can. I would like to ask you one more thing.
Sure.
I sort of come to a conclusion, like when I see a dog or a cat or a bird, I no longer see something different. I sort of see life, just life, the same thing as I would see in another human being. So I think I would like to ask you, as like, where is that? Is this sort of a quote unquote correct thought?
Yeah, we're not very much like that. I mean, yeah, as you say, quote unquote. For us, it's just about being mindful. If you have that thought, you should be aware of that thought.
Mm-hmm.
See that thought as arising and ceasing. It comes to your mind and it ceases. Because if you react to it, you say that's good, and you feel happy about it, you'll become attached to it. You'll become even egotistical about it.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Yeah. There's not really good and bad experiences. There's only your reactions to them. I mean, there are those experiences of wisdom, of understanding, but even those should be seen as thoughts that arise and cease. And they come more often. As you practice meditation, you'll start to see clearer, and insights will come. You'll clear up
okay.
And straighten up.
But, like, if you do not have that that pressure from the sort of humanity, that pressure from your feelings, I think that a lot of things wouldn't have been done. For example, I read a lot about Tesla or Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
You have these people which are driven by something on the inside, and of course they have you can definitely argue that they're not mindful at all times, but nonetheless it gives some kind of a progress. So
the question is, progress to what? Where are we headed?
Yes, right. Sort of yesterday you talked about Bernie Sanders and sort of a mild socialism, how we all should work together, but then again, work for what?
Right.
If
well, it's
progress.
It's not quite like that. It's we should be good to each other. We should cultivate goodness, because that's what leads to something. What we're working towards is freedom. Freedom from suffering. But that only comes through goodness. So goodness is a good thing. Goodness is leading to progress. That's why I like Bernie Sanders, not because he's going to, I don't know, lead America somewhere, but he's making the world a better place. He's bringing people to greater goodness. I can see that. You know, his followers are becoming more conscious as people, and taking his example of not being a negative. He's not running a negative campaign, you know. And he's showing people, you know, to rise above this hatred and divisiveness and so on. I think he's doing that. I mean, I don't mean to praise him too much, but it's just the goodness factor, I think, is there. I'm sure he's not a saint. I think he gets angry a lot. But his heart, I think, is, as they say, in the right place for the most part.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. And if I have further questions, I'm going to join you again on your session.
Sure. Well, I'd push you to read my book, or to read the booklet and start meditating, because this is really for a forum for meditators. So if you're if you're not interested in meditation, we're not really geared towards non-meditative dialogue.
No, I am interested. I am very interested, but I fail to utilize it in my everyday schedule.
Okay, well, you have your homework then.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Have a good night. And good night, everyone. That's all for tonight.